We start with a serious topic, but an interesting chat about various aspects of it. Domestic violence not only increased last year, reported the New Zealand Herald. The brutality of attacks and severity of injuries was significantly worse, according to victims' advocates. Globally, a quarter of women and girls have been abused by a partner, says the World Health Organization. Joe Killington's even made this the topic of a new single.
He's on the other side of the door, trying to talk you round again. Whispering words you've already heard, and you're nearly caving in. Here he goes, heavy blows, tears are raining down. Just keep your eyes closed. All the hurt and the scars, they ain't healing now. But if you let me close, I will be your painkiller. Call me when you're trembling on the floor, and I will fix your heart for you. If you let me, I will be your cure.
Obviously, there are hundreds of millions of good men in the world too, both as fathers and as role models, and new research suggests a triumph of biology may be at work when becoming a father. At the start of Men's Health Week, this is a look at their brains as well as their bodies. Professor James Rilling is with the Emory Research University in Atlanta. He's a professor of anthropology who's an expert in the hormones of the brain and brain evolution, and his laboratory uses sophisticated brain scanning techniques to find out what happens inside our heads and with our hormones to make us act in the ways we do. Professor James Rilling, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. You were taking your five-year-old son, as he was then, to his swimming lesson on a hot day in Atlanta, and as you walked towards the pool, what did you notice, please, James?
Yeah, well, interesting. I was walking by an infant swim class. Most of the parents were, in fact, fathers, and I was sort of struck by that, and I was struck by just how sensitive caregivers they seem to be. And the thought crossed my mind, just, you know, were these men, were they always this way? Or did the act of becoming a father in some way change them?
Yes. So the essential question for you was, are men biologically, not just emotionally, transformed by fatherhood?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right.
We know, however vaguely, most of us, about the hormonal changes in women, which are quite complicated, when they become mothers. One thing that interested you, I think, was why statistics are bad for children raised without fathers. And this is not to besmirch the often amazing efforts of sole parenting mothers and the way they succeed in obviating any bad outcomes suggested by the statistics. But you were interested in the whole area of fathers benefiting children too, weren't you?
And, you know, there's now a great deal of evidence that when children have fathers that are positively engaged with them, that they do better on average. Academically, they tend to do better socially, and they tend to do better psychologically. Yeah, you're absolutely right. There are a lot of single mothers that make Herculean efforts and do a great job raising their children. But by and large, when fathers are positively involved, that benefits children.
You recruited dads with children 1 to 3 years of age. What were you looking for, James, and what did you find, please?
Well, our first question was simply, what are the biological differences between fathers and non-fathers. So most basically, we began by looking at just hormone levels. The fathers had significantly lower levels of the hormone testosterone than did the non-fathers. In addition to that, they had actually higher levels of another hormone, which is called oxytocin. And that's particularly interesting because oxytocin is sort of traditionally, classically thought of as a maternal hormone, but what we found is that fathers have more of this than non-fathers, and there's now more and more evidence that oxytocin is not only important for mother-infant bonding, but it also seems to be important for father-infant bonding.
There was already research into birds showing similar findings with testosterone reduction and in other primates, I think.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the classic work has been done in other animal species, and the most compelling work, as you say, in birds. So, for example, one classic study where you take a bird species that is polygynous and non-paternal, and they have higher testosterone levels than a species that is monogamous and paternal. And the amazing thing is, if you give the monogamous paternal species additional testosterone, you actually transform them such that they become polygynous and non-paternal. And so that was pretty compelling evidence that testosterone is a hormone that sort of biases males away from parenting effort and more towards mating effort.
And just to summarize as we go, so it is actual fatherhood, not just some kind propensity among males to be nice to children and care for them, because non-fathers don't respond to children the way fathers do biologically.
I think it probably depends on the nature of that relationship and how intimate the interactions are with the children. I'm sure that, you know, there are a lot of very loving stepfathers who I would expect would have similar responses to their stepchildren as the biological fathers did to their own children.
Okay. When we hear the phrase loss of testosterone, we may think of a downgraded male, one who's stopped competing, you know, battling, preening, and so on. Is it like that or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think I definitely see the point, but it's an important point that having high testosterone levels is not always a great thing. In certain contexts, sure, it can be helpful. But as far as parenting goes, there are some things that testosterone interferes with. So one of those is emotion regulation. Another is closely related is frustration tolerance. And when you're a parent of a young infant that's doing a lot of crying and sometimes inconsolable crying, it's easy to get frustrated. And so it makes a lot of sense for fathers to be down-regulating their testosterone so they have a better ability to regulate their negative emotional reaction to the crying. It's also a time when you really want your energy focused on the infant rather than other types of pursuits. And testosterone often biases men towards more sort of competitive and the pursuit of status, pursuit of mates, that's those sorts of activities.
And so the men with the higher testosterone, where the hormone didn't subside in them enough as fathers, and I suppose that happens, tend to be less involved with their children?
Yeah, in our data, that was the case. So the fathers who had higher testosterone levels were reported by the mother as being less involved in the day-to-day instrumental caregiving of the infant. And there are other studies showing that fathers with higher testosterone levels tend to touch their infants less. Lower testosterone is more conducive with that.
It also fuels that kind of narrative that we know, I think, of the big strong guy, the winner in life or in business, not really caring much about his children, not a deadbeat dad, but a don't care dad. So there's some truth in that.
I mean, there may be. It's important to remember, though, that when we look at hormone levels, we're only able to explain a small proportion of variance in paternal caregiving. So there are a lot of other very important factors that contribute. Obviously, things like the occupational demands that a father faces,
yeah,
social and cultural norms, the availability of other caregivers. So we've identified one of what I think are probably many different contributors to the extent to which men are involved in caregiving.
Professor James Rilling is with us. And actual skin contact between dads and their kids, hugs and so on, does what?
Well, there's evidence to show that it increases oxytocin levels, in the father. And this mainly comes from research in which parents of premature infants would spend time holding the infant with skin-to-skin contact on their torso. And that's been shown to increase oxytocin levels, not only in the parent, but also in the infant, which from everything we know is likely to promote parent-infant bonding.
So what the men lose in testosterone as fathers, they make up for in oxytocin. We hear a lot about oxytocin. It appears to do so much heavy lifting in the brain. It's confusing. So that swap involves what? Could you elaborate on that a wee bit more?
On the role of oxytocin?
Yes. Is it just a general kindness and concern role?
I think its most fundamental role is in attachment and bonding. If I were going to say its kind of more general function, it is involved in increasing the salience of social stimuli and also the reward of positive social interactions. We see evidence for that in the brain. So we've conducted research where we give fathers additional oxytocin above and beyond that which they produce themselves. And what we find is when they view pictures of their child, that the oxytocin increases their brain's response to that child within areas of the brain that are involved in reward and motivation. And so we think that oxytocin may be rendering the child a more rewarding stimulus to the father.
There are oxytocin nasal sprays, aren't there? So presumably, and I don't mean this entirely flippantly, you could obtain one to make you play with your children more.
Yeah, I think you're right that there are nasal sprays. I think you're pointing to, I mean, there are some men who suffer a serious sort of lack of parental motivation, often due to things like postnatal depression or drug dependence. And I think that's the direction the field is moving, that potentially there may be a clinical use for oxytocin in men like that.
So the big question is, what triggers the hormonal changes in the men? I mean, is it just the power of the mind affecting the body?
It seems to be important that fathers actually are engaged with the infant. You know, they've shown that when fathers are distant and they're not interacting with their children much, that you don't see the same degree of hormonal changes. And we don't really have a good handle on what that cue is yet.
The fact is that in some species, males kill their young. In the human species, all this oxytocin still fails to stop violence towards children. So, as you say, it's multifactorial. This is powerful, but it's not the only power involved.
You're right. That, I mean, one of the disturbing sort of statistics out there is that fathers are more likely to abuse infants than mothers are. The decrease in testosterone makes sense, but it may be sort of an imperfect adaptation. And in some cases, you know, some men may not be perfectly adapted for this infant caregiving role. But I do think that these changes in testosterone and oxytocin are probably helping.
In connection with that, you have found, or seem to have found, I think, that fathers who are more rewarded by their children become more involved in the caregiving. So how can children reward their fathers more? I mean, what does that require?
The fathers whose brain responds the most in these reward system areas when they see their child tend to be more involved in taking care of the child, again, as reported by the mother. And that could mean either that, you know, the fathers who are more sort of rewarded by the appearance of their child are more drawn into a caregiving role. But it could also be that fathers who take the initiative to spend more time with their child come to form a stronger bond with the child, and then the child becomes a more rewarding stimulus. Children have a lot of different ways of reaching into that parental brain and sort of stimulating those reward systems. you know, their basic appearance, how cute they are. They're designed by evolution to be cute, and their smiles, their laughter. So much of what they do is really designed to solicit parental care from us.
And it sounds to me like this is best done early. In other words, right at the start of life, it would be great if fathers can be as involved as they possibly can be, hence the benefit of parental leave and so on. But this sounds pretty crucial.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The sooner you can form that bond, the better, and you know, the stronger it's going to be, and the easier it is, it's going to be to get involved and stay involved.
Something called empathic over-arousal, just finally while we're on this topic, maybe to blame for fathers being antagonistic to their small children as well, James?
Yeah, we have found that actually younger fathers compared to older fathers, younger fathers report that they find infant cries to be more aversive. And when we look at their brains, you know, you might think that their brains are reacting less to infant cries, but they're actually reacting more in areas that we know from other work are involved in empathy. So, you know, basically when an infant is crying, it's in some sense, it's forcing the caregiver to share in its distress. And so we very much expect systems in the brain that are involved in empathy to be activated by that. But if they become overactive and the parent takes on the distress of the infant to too great of an extent, then the parent can actually become sort of mired in personal distress and become kind of stressed out themselves. And that can interfere with compassionate caregiving.
So that triumph of evolved intelligence, the prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for this, it allows most men to override, you know, ancient propagating impulses to stay faithful to the family. They're not cheating on Tinder or using their money if they're rich, you know, to play the field when they've got commitments at home. It's the good dads, often the plodding along dads, I imagine, who have actually achieved more in their lives, James. This is really important.
You're right. The prefrontal cortex is what helps us to make some of these decisions that, while they might not be in our evolutionary reproductive interests, they're probably in our best interest in terms of living a, you know, a happy and fulfilling life and reaching the goals that we aspire to in the longer term. It's a good thing that we have a prefrontal cortex and we should make good use of it.
Yeah, I didn't want to sound too moralizing, but it seems like it's a bit of a triumph for society that this all happens.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely agree with you there. We owe a lot to that part of our brain, which is much better developed than in other species.
Just a final question. Your son is a good swimmer these days?
He's decent. There's other sports he excels at more, but it's been really the greatest joy of my life to kind of go through that journey with him. So, yeah, thank you for asking.
Not at all. No problem with your oxytocin levels from the sound of it. Hey, lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much for the fascinating research and for your time.
It was my pleasure. It was nice talking with you.
Professor James Rilling from the Emory Research University in Atlanta.